Good evening, and it's such a joy to be a Green Belt. Green Belt for me is a grassy sacrament at the end of every August, and I couldn't miss it. I wouldn't want to, and I couldn't. For me, it's a time to reflect on the year that's gone by, to reflect on all the talks that I miss, and then to catch up with people and to be delighted to have yet another chai in the tiny tea tent. And it is a real joy to be here, and thank you for coming. There's a signing afterwards, and I'd love to meet as many as you as want, and you don't even have to buy a book, although I'm sure they'd be happy if you did. So tonight, the theme for the poetry reading is When Certainty Fails, and I suppose I'm going to be looking at when various kinds of certainty, certainty of national identity, certainty of belief, certainty of personal identity begins to fade a little bit and begins to become a little bit more flexible, and what is possible when that happens. I'm going to start off with a poem, which what you need to know for it is that in Scotland and in Northern Ireland, the banks produce their own money. So you can get a kind of a Bank of Ireland £5 note or an Allied Irish Bank £5 note. It's got the Queen on it and all. And in Scotland as well, the Clydesdale Bank and the different banks can do that. It used to be that when you ever came to England and you had a £5 note from Bank of Ireland or whatever, and it's sterling, and you'd be buying a pint or something like that, and somebody would go, "That's Irish money." And you go, "No, it's not. It's got the Queen on it." And one thing that Irish people wouldn't have if it was real Irish money is we wouldn't have the Queen on it. And so I did my undergraduate in Birmingham. And one time on a Saturday, the last Saturday in July, I was just finished a four-hour Christology exam. And the Christology exam went from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And then there was a lecture conveniently placed from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. with a convenient 15-minute break for coffee halfway through. And I thought, absolutely not. No self-respecting person should be writing 4 hours of Christology on the last Saturday in July anyway. So me and my friend said, we're going to go off for a few pints. We're in a part of Birmingham that we didn't know. And the following happened. It's pretty much word for word for how it came. And the poem is called Enjoy Your Pint. At the bar, in an unknown part of Birmingham, I bought two pints and paid with paper money from the northern part of Ireland. "That's not British money," said the publican. And I said, "Yes, it is. You'll see the royal head if you hold it to the light." And a man sitting right beside me at the bar said, "So you're from Northern Ireland." He was wearing denim jeans and a denim jacket, tobacco fingers fixed around a half-drunk pint. He moved a little closer, locked small eyes on me and looked. "Tell me," he said, "whose side are you on, son? Whose side are you on?" And I did not know the landscape of belonging in this part of England. I couldn't construct an answer according to the flag I thought he claimed. I hadn't seen the signs to know whether his hope was for the orange or the green. He continued to look. He continued to keep close. And I said, "I work for peace." And he said, "That's a very clever answer, son. That's a very clever answer." And I said, "I know." "Enjoy your pint." And I got up to go. So one of the complicating ideas that I think can be helpful for us in terms of the erosion of certainty is the certainty of the singularity of identity. I am who I am. And identity shares etymological roots with the word identical. And we can imagine if you turn up somewhere and they say, "Can I see your ID?" The idea that there's something that says, "This is who you are." I mean, often it's about when you were born, but "This is who I am." The idea that identity is in any way fixed or in any way permanent or in any way singular. I am many people, depending as to who I'm with. And just because I'm one type of person around my family and another around another, and a different type of person around another people, it doesn't necessarily invalidate either of those. It just means that identity is fluid and multiple and rich, really. And that can be complicated for us. And I suppose I want to look at a few poems to do with what does it mean to reflect on I am part of the stories that I tell. And I think that stories can be very beneficial within that, because stories shouldn't, maybe they do, but they shouldn't necessarily colonize us. So there's a few poems in the Exile book reflecting on narrative theology. I didn't actually know what narrative theology was when I wrote these poems, but I decided to make it up for myself, which I think is part of how religion can help us. Because somebody somewhere at one point in writing all the sacred texts that we honor in our world said, I'm going to write this down and I'm going to say something about what I want God to say or what I believe God is saying for us through writing. And the creative endeavor of that and the creative risk of that is partly making it up. And sometimes by making it up, we might land on something that's more true than the truth we're trying to say. And so I think story can be like that for us, especially in helping us move beyond very fixed notions of this thing or the other thing. So the first one is called Narrative Theology Number One, conveniently named. And I said to him, are there answers to all of this? And he said, the answer is in a story, and the story is being told. And I said, but there is so much pain. And she answered plainly, pain will happen. And then I said, will I ever find meaning? And they said, you will find meaning where you give meaning. The answer is in a story, and the story isn't finished. Narrative theology number two is trying to engage with questions to do with what does it mean to think of the biblical text as literature. And literature, we can ask questions about characterization, about plot, about structure, about whether it's a satisfactory ending, whether we like the way it starts, whether we think it's consistent with itself. And especially literature allows you to ask questions about what are the cracks in the text. And I often feel particularly sorry for Lot's wife, she who was turned into salt when she turned around to accuse God in a certain sense for the turning of a city into sulfur. So she makes a little cameo appearance in this as a hero. So narrative theology number two. I used to need to know the end to every story, but these days I only need the start to get me going. God is the crack where the story begins. We are the crack where the story gets interesting. We are the choice of where to begin, the person going out or the stranger coming in. God is the fracture and the ache in your voice. God is the story flavored with choice. God is the pillar of salt full of pity, accusing God for the sulfurous city. God is the woman who bleeds and who touches. We are the story of courage or blushes. God is the story of whatever works. God is the twist at the end and the quirks. We are the start and we're at the center. We're the characters, narrators, inventors, and God is the bit that we can't explain. Maybe the harmony, maybe the strain. We are the bit that God can't explain. Maybe the healing, maybe the pain. And God is the plot, and we are the writers, the story of winners, the story of fighters, the story of love, and the story of rupture, the story of stories, and the story without structure. A few years ago, my mum was telling me a story. My mum is a fierce one for owning multiple microwave ovens. The first microwave oven we bought, we bought it in Wales on our first foreign holiday, and we covered it with all of our clothing in the back of the car and smuggled it home to Cork. And I was nervous the whole way home because I was worried that the police were going to ransack the car, we were all going to be arrested, and there was this enormous, it was about the size of this podium, microwave oven in the back of the car. So Mum, there's a spider that I've just killed. Mum has a great love for the old microwave oven. And the only thing that's better than a microwave oven is two microwave ovens. And she currently has three. She's trying to offload one onto me. So anyway, she had bought a microwave oven from Lidl's, which is great and powerful, apparently. You know Lidl? And so this isn't an advertisement. They're not paying us. And so, and it was faulty. And so she'd taken it home and it wasn't working. She was upset and she phoned them up and they said, actually, that whole batch seemed to be faulty and there's an easy way for you to get it replaced. Just phone this number. It's a call center in England. They'll give them this reference and they'll come. And if you want the money back, that's fine. Or they'll bring another one there and then to swap it. And that's fine. So mum phoned up the number. And she spoke to somebody who sounded like she had a North of England accent. And the woman said, that's grand. Yeah, there's loads of people having to phone us because that batch is faulty. Give us the details. And said, what's your name? She told them her name. And then she said, the woman on the phone said to my mum, can you give me the address? And my mum gave the address of the townland where we live, where they live. It's a townland. There's no street name, really, or house number. The townland and the village and County Cork, Carrigaline, County Cork, which is the address. And then the woman said, where's that? And my mother conversationally said, up the road from the Protestant church. Which is entirely correct. If you want to know how to get to my parents' house, you go to Carrigaline, you go through the village, along to the Protestant church, and then at the Protestant church, you go up the road. And that's where the house is. And the woman, slightly bewildered, but nonetheless professional, said to my mum, I'm afraid I don't understand what you're telling me. And then my mum realised her mistake and said, Ireland. Thank you very much. And mum was still blushing, God love her, when she told me. And I promise not to tell anybody. The reason I say this is because entirely, she was totally correct. Because the woman said, where is that? And my mum, for whom the whole world is the local parish, was thinking, oh, she might pop by, or she might know it, or she might say, I know the neighbours, or isn't that a lovely road? All kinds of things that she could have said. And it made me think of locality and parochial and the world. And what does it mean for us to live in a particular area? And I grew up in Cork and then travelled around the place. I had a kind of a nomadic decade where I lived for a bit in Dublin and then Switzerland and Australia and Uganda and the Philippines and visited places for work. And then I moved to Belfast across the border. And I have never really experienced as much culture shock as I did when I moved just across a border, because I lived in a kind of a Protestant area. I lived in a Catholic area and worked in a Protestant area. So some of my local neighbours are like, oh, you're from Cork. Sure, my sister lives in Limerick, or I used to live in Tipperary or whatever. Ireland was a parish then. But then I'd cross over the Peace Line, our 46-foot high wall, and people would say, oh, you're from that foreign country. And it was complicated. And Catholics tend to call what's north of the border the north, or the north of Ireland, or the six counties, or the occupied territory, if they're feeling particularly daring. Protestants tend to call it Northern Ireland, or the province, and they might refer to Britain as the mainland. And so the very name for where you are is contested. And you can tell a lot by what people call a locality. And so there's a poem that I'd like to read for you, which is designed to irritate everybody, which is called The Northern of Ireland. Some of the questions that particularly plague us in our political process in the North at the moment are, what does it mean to reckon with the past? And what does it mean to find celebrations and commemorations that speak to who we are together rather than continue to deepen divisions? And so this poem makes no attempt whatsoever to answer any of those. It's called The Northern of Ireland. It is both a dignity and a difficulty to live between these names, perceiving politics in the syntax of the state. And at the end of the day, the reality is that whether we change or whether we stay the same, these questions will remain. Who are we to be with one another? And how are we to be with one another? And what to do with all those memories of all those funerals? And what about those present whose past was blasted far beyond their future? I wake. You wake. She wakes. He wakes. We wake and take this troubled beauty forward. I mentioned last night at the 10x9, we had done a storytelling session yesterday with some of the young people, and they told kind of two sentence or even one sentence stories, which were fantastic. And I love what it is that young people tell you when they can begin to trust that you're not going to try to colonize it into saying, well, the proper answer is, and if they feel like they can tell you something, they tell you something quite fascinating. So one of the stories yesterday, we'd asked young people to tell a story about some of the quirky people they live with, i.e. their parents, particularly their dads. Although this one story I'm going to tell you, it goes against that trend. So one young lad, he must have been around 9, and my apologies to his mother if she's here. One young lad said, "My mother snores like a pig. And my auntie, who's hairy, purrs like a pussycat." That was the end of the story. He sat down. And so, I mean, it's as elegant as a haiku. Like, it's quite extraordinary. The whole world is present in that. Another fella got up and said, "My dad always aims his farts at me and my brother, and never at my sister." End of the story. I suppose why I'm saying this to you is because I think what young people can say can be quite fascinating, and also what our young selves perceived can also tell us an enormous amount. I used to be a school chaplain and used to do Ignatian meditations with young people, and they'd be taking a walk and they'd meet Jesus, and Jesus would say hello and they'd have a chat. And I loved that job. And one time a young person said to me, "You know, when you were leading us through that guided meditation, I ignored you totally because I was bored." And I was like, "No problem." And she said, "So instead I took a walk on the ocean." She imagined herself walking on the ocean. And she said, "Along the ocean, I saw Jesus coming towards me wearing a purple tutu and a coconut bra." Wow. And with this particular age group, they were making their confirmation. So they're around 12 years old. And they were coming to us for a day of religious reflection, and they were all supposed to, they had a sheet of paper in the shape of a kite, each of them did, and they were supposed to draw what they saw in their imagination on the piece of paper, and then that would be put together into a beautiful religious and devout collage for the classroom and for presentation to the bishop. And she said to me, "I'm not a very good drawer." And I was like, and she said, "I think I'm just going to colour it in purple." I was like, "Thank God." But I was a small bit disappointed, because it would have been great fun to have seen it, and I possibly would have stolen it then, to have seen what she'd have done. There was another young person said, I was trying to say to them, "What stories from the Bible do you remember?" And one of them was like, "Oh, there's something son, the prostitute's son." I was like, nobody knew what it was. They were all far too young, and so they weren't even finding that amusing, apart from me. Was wondering, should I fill in a child protection form afterwards? And then I went, really good. It's not quite that word, because I couldn't say it. It's another word beginning with, you know, similar. And she went, "Oh, Protestant, the Protestant song." Anyway, with a little bit of prodding, he got towards prodigal. Another young person said once, the meditation said, take a walk somewhere lovely and meet the character of Jesus in Nazareth and have a conversation with him in your imagination. It wasn't saying it's the actual Son of God you're meeting. It was just the one from your imagination. And one young girl said, "I was walking on the surface of the moon, of the sun, and I was being burnt, and I thought I might be burnt alive, and I thought, this is hotter than hell. And along came Jesus in a thick bubble, and he was protected from everything." And what I thought was fascinating was how in a young person's imagination, she had understood one of the complications of trying to believe that God ever became like us, the complication. There she was being burnt on fire, hotter than hell, and there came Jesus in a thick bubble, and he was totally protected from everything that was burning her. I suppose I want to say that because I'm going to tell you a poem about people who spoke about what they learned about conflict when they were young. And Charlotte Delbo, who survived, if that's the right word, 2.5 years in Auschwitz, speaks of the death of imagination of one of the things that made her feel like she was really beginning to lose her own humanity. And so these are poems about the imagination and the complication of the imagination. One person said that when they were a child, because they had a parent in the police, and they were taught to lie, because in the north of Ireland, you never say your mummy or your daddy's in the police. You say they're in the civil service or whatever, because otherwise you might become a legitimate target. Somebody else who'd grown up in a Republican paramilitary family said that they were taught never answer the door. If anybody knocks the door, never answer it. And like a really bad and predictable afternoon film script, the door had been knocked one day and she had answered it and a gun was held to her head. And it was terrible. And then somebody else in the room said that they had taken a life. Somebody else in the room said that they had murdered somebody. Somebody else said it was a war. They were legitimate targets in this war. And then somebody else said, well, I guess I was eight. When I was eight, I was a legitimate target because a gun was held to my head. And it was complicated to hear adults still tell truths that they'd learned when they were five, six, seven, and eight. So this poem is called The Pedagogy of Conflict, in trying to reflect a little bit of that. The Pedagogy of Conflict. When I was a child, I learned to lie. When I was a child, my parents said that sometimes lives are protected by an undetected light lie of deception. When I was a child, I learned to lie, and now I am more than 25, and I'm alive because I've lied, and I am lying still. Sometimes it's the only way of living. When I was a child, I learned that I could stay alive by obeying certain rules. Let your anger cool before you blossom bruises on your brother's shoulder. Always show your manners at the table. Always keep the rules and never question. Never mention certain things to certain people. Never doubt the reasons behind legitimate aggression. If you compromise or humanize, you must still even out the score and never open up the door. Never open up the door. Never, never, never open up the blasted door. When I was a child, I learned that I could stay alive by obeying certain rules. Never open up the door. When I was a child, I learned to count to five. One, two, three, four, five. But these days, I've been counting lives. So I count one life. One life, one life, one life, one life, because each time is the first time that that life has been taken. Legitimate target has 16 letters and one long, abominable space between two dehumanizing words. I rejoice in the fine accolade of having scored the highest ever in the Pontifical University that I attended on an essay to do with hell. I'm not entirely sure how I should read that. My course supervisor said, that's a remarkable score and a remarkable thing to score so highly in. And he looked at me like I needed spiritual direction, which I probably did. The child who mentioned walking on the surface of the sun and being burnt and the flames were hotter than hell got me thinking about hell and how can we speak about hell in a way that makes sense. And a few years ago at Greenbelt, we had a conversation about hell, trying to say, how can we speak about it maturely? How can we speak about it in a way that makes sense to modern life and isn't just vengeance of a dreadful God? So I read Hans-Urs von Balthasar's Theodrama, which is exhausting and well worth it for the two or three pages of it that I understood. and it's a many-volumed book. And so there's a poem here called Go to Hell, because a few theologians have said important things, like if we are to try to understand heaven on earth in the way that we understand the kingdom of heaven, that we should really understand that also there are places that are hell on earth. And in as much as we hope for heaven and we hope for some kind of beatitude in our lives, we must also understand that the mission to respond to the good news, if that's what interests us, is to think of finding out the little hells all around us and being brave in the face of those little hells. And so this poem is about trying to be brave in the face of a little hell. And it's called Go to Hell. He is called to hell, this man. He is called to glory. He knows well those twisted ways and those who've lost their story. He is called to clay, this man. He is called to yearning. He has heard of hidden streams to heal those tired of burning. He's searching out those raised in hell. He wants to know the things they know because he believes in dreamland where the ragged people go. He is called to quiet now. He is called to silence, to squat down on the breaking ground with those who've swallowed violence. He is called to anguished thoughts. He is called to flowers, to find in hell's own lonely fury that which no flame devours. I saw him on the midway path. I saw he carried two things only. On his trip to hell, this man, he is called to story. I've been intrigued for years by the form of collect. I think collect is a fascinating form. I hadn't really understood it. I used to lie to my parents and sneak along to Protestant services. Some people used to do actual interesting things when they rebelled, but I used to go down to the local Anglican church. I'd call around to my friend Cahill's house and I'd say, if my parents ring, tell them that I've just left and I'm walking home. He thought I might have been getting a bit of action. And he said, where are you going? And I go, the Protestant church. And he thought I was peculiar, which he was probably correct about. And so I initially thought that collect was just what Protestants called a collect. They didn't know what they were talking about. And then I read a lovely book by Walter Wangerin Jr. speaking about poetic form when it comes to religious verse, and he spoke about collect. And collect, you address the deity and then you speak afterwards something to do, you reflect the character of the deity that you're reflecting, and then you name your request, and then you give a reason for why the deity should grant your request, which links back to the character of the deity, and then you say amen. And so it would be something like, dear friend, who is more generous than generous? Lend me your bike, because you are more generous than generous, in the name of our deep friendship. Amen. That's a kind of a bad version of the structure of collect. And I am interested in terms of saying, if prayer is to mean anything, it has to mean something real for now. In the Ignatian session with young people earlier on, I said to them, what would you ask Jesus if you could? And one of them said, I'm not sure what I think of him, because I'm not sure that I have much respect for somebody who died without putting up a fight. What an astonishing insight, and what independence of thought, and what ease of speaking her own mind. And she was so worthy of respect for having spoken that in an environment where she might have been subject to, no, that's the wrong answer, young person. And I think prayer, if it is to mean anything, whether or not we finally believe in God or if we're only agnostic on our best days, I think that's how I am sometimes. I think prayer can mean something because it tells us the truth about our desire. And so there are three collects here, which I wrote during difficult times, which were trying to wrestle some kind of meaning from days when I wasn't sure what I believed in. God of watching, whose gaze I doubt and rally against both, but in which I nonetheless take refuge despite my limited vision, shelter me today against the flitting nature of my own focus, and bring me to the calm place in which to stand. And when I falter, which is likely, give me both the courage and the kindness to begin again with hope and coping. For you are the one whose watchfulness is steady, I hope. God of silence, who watches our growth and our decay, who watches tsunamis and summer holidays, who cares for the widow, the orphan, the banker, the terrorist, the politician, the freedom fighter. We pray to be nurtured in the generosity of our own silences. We pray that we might find in these silences truth, compassion, fatigue. Because you see all and are often silent, and we need to hope that you are not inattentive to our needs. God of darkness, you must be the God of darkness, because if you are not, who else can we turn to? Turn to us now. Turn to us. Turn your face towards us, because it is dark here and we are in need. We are people in need. We can barely remember our own truth. And if you too have forgotten, then we are without a hope of a map. Turn to us. Turn to us now. Turn to us, because you turn to us in the body. You turn to us. Amen. My mother has an extraordinary capacity to speak about God in a way that is generous to the human experience. A few years ago, she'd said to me, would I come along to her midweek rosary group? And the rosary group takes place in a room around the size of this stage area here. And there's a fire lit in one corner. There's an electric heater stuck on the wall in another. And then there's a gas heater, just for safety, lit in the corner, but probably on low. And then they say the rosary, and it's a little bit like a mixture of a Bikram yoga and a seance all at once. Uncomfortable. But it's rhythmic and it's easy, and you know the words, and you pray along, and inevitably my mother falls asleep and begins to snore gently. It's astonishing, her capacity to do that. I know that I have sometimes inherited that capacity myself, but my mother takes it to an Olympic level. Anyway, the first time this happened, we were coming home in the car afterwards, and I said to her, did you have a nice sleep? And she said, oh, that wasn't a sleep, Padraig. That wasn't a sleep. That was a holy sleep. And I said, no, it was a sleep. And she went, it's a holy sleep. When you fall asleep in prayer like that and you wake up so refreshed, you know it's a gift from God. And I was saying, that's what's called a snooze, Mum. Like, that's why we like it. But Mum was utterly convinced that no, this has arrived like a gift from heaven, soporific from God. And I went home and thought I couldn't sleep. And ironically enough, and I thought I'll write a poem, kind of taking the piss out of my poor old mother. But as I wrote it, I thought of the generosity that she had given to herself in putting a holy name on something as ordinary as falling asleep and finding a way in the middle of a tiring life and in the middle of a place when you're with friends to honour, I'm tired and I fall asleep and I wake up, and to welcome that like it actually does come from God. And it doesn't really matter if it does or it doesn't, because she made it up in such a way that now I know for a fact that there are people around the world who welcome holy sleeps. And because my mother called them holy sleeps, they too call them holy sleeps. She'd be mortified if she knew. But so here's a poem called Hoth's Soft Heather. At my mother's prayer group on a Wednesday night, some of the ladies fall asleep from time to time, from bead to bead, from prayer to prayer. They call it a holy sleep, thus sanctifying their little dozes. Even the fire respects those sacred snoozes, settling down comfortably to the business of glowing gently, strongly, silently. 12 warm bodies in a cozy firelit den near the harbour and the old circus site. A holy sleep that brings supernatural rest and renewal. A kind of coma into which you slip mid-prayer and emerge post-trauma, spiritually nurtured to the gentle rhythm of clicking rosaries, intoned voices, centuries prayers. There are silent presences watching those asleep and those awake, hearing all those needs you daren't pray aloud for fear of clicking cups on saucers a coffee morning later. They are watching those we love and those we hate to leave, and hearing all those prayers voiced again, just like last Wednesday, for healing and a hope to find a kindly face. And the sacred thing about this sleep is that it is thus called, thus loved, thus named, thus recognized and welcomed, like a snooze on Hoth's soft heather on a hot sunny September afternoon by 12 lonely souls who were looking towards the chat and the biscuits waiting on the pressed white cloth and hoping that their fire will burn more bright. Years ago, I heard of a priest who had a ministry to homosexuals, and that could mean a whole variety of things, but in this case, it was utterly trustable. And I wrote him, God love him, it must have been 10 pages of typed letter, and sent it to him. And he wrote back slightly bewildered and said, thank you for your lengthy letter. Felt like Mr. Collins in Pride and Prejudice. We met up because I was distressed. I had been told over and over and over again that if I could find the reason about what turned me gay, that therefore that knowledge, that sacred knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or the knowledge of straight and queer, if I had that knowledge, that something fundamentally would be unearthed and I'd be turned back to the heterosexual that I should have been. So I had this desperate desire for knowledge, and a really bad kind of knowledge, a real pathological addiction to something certain. And so we chatted away, and he said to me, what intrigues me is that if you could find the thing that turned you gay, what would it do? And he asked the question with such ease, respect, but genuine curiosity that it unearthed something in me. His question allowed me to go, that's a very fine point. And I walked away, not feeling ripped apart by somebody deconstructing something that was meaningful, but he'd allowed a small bit of wonder and curiosity to enter in. The Irish way of saying curiosity is ávrla úm, to observe with wonder. And so I found myself observing with wonder a very fine question. And it helped me, I think, begin to tell a story to myself, which was rescuing me from a pathological story that had resulted in me being sent along for exorcisms and cure and therapy and healing prayer. And Jesus was told to help me, to hinder me, to lift things off, to put things on, to wrap his arms around me, to release me, to let me grow up. You know, Jesus was particularly busy in all the prayers. And he was never overly interested in turning me into heterosexual Padraig. And so this man's question really was one of the small conversions that helped make me go, I think I'm asking the wrong question. And I think there's a certainty, which is a fantasy. It's not even a fantasy, because fantasy is too good a genre. It's like bad fiction, predictable fiction, and really poor. And it really helped me. And as time went by, I began to realize that being gay in the world of religion was actually quite helpful in a variety of ways in terms of helping you think positively and helpfully and carefully and wisely about what it means to be human. And there's a few poems I'd like to read to you about this. In conflict mediation, one of the things you try to do is to consider when conflict is escalating, how can you do something to bring in an element of surprise rather than engaging and trying to meet hostility with hostility or trying to meet grief with argument. How can you do something that surprises you into a new way of being with each other? So there's a small poem here called Returnings, and it happened in an airport a few years ago. I see her, former colleague in the baggage area of a foreign airport. Oh, hi, she says, looking awkwardly toward the empty carousel. And then she decides, I hear you're gay now, she says. Are you still a Christian? Oh, how will we tell the story? She to her friends with sadness, curiosity, and prayers for reorientation and returning. And me to mine with sadness, anger, and prayers for refocusing the lenses and returning. And the anger was all mine, but that question was all about her. Should we not just dance instead, I should have said, together turn a little waltz in the chorus of our own bodies while we wait and wait and wait for something better than the empty carousel of this question? How will we tell this story? How will I tell this story? With sadness with practicings of little ballroom dances while we wait confidently for what is most important to be returned. I went about a year ago, not quite a year ago, to Uganda to work with clergy there who were in public support of what was then called the Kill the Gays Bill, which was a bill going through Parliament to punish people who were convicted of being gay with the death penalty. And I was interested in the sense that much of the interventions that were happening were on the basis of this is against human rights. And it was being made, that argument was being made to people for whom the moral narrative was the biblical text, not human rights. And so I thought, it's the wrong intervention. So I wrote to some funders that I knew and said, I think it would be much more interesting to work with the moral narrative that's there and felt to be indigenous and see whether you could devise something there. And went along, and we designed this program, and then they asked, would I go? And so I thought about it, and we introduced a safety clause to the contract, and then went, and we had discussions about what does it mean to consider that the marginalized have something to tell us and something to teach us, rather than even pity. Even pity is better than killing people, but even pity isn't good enough. Because the marginalized in the society, and I know John Bell was saying this earlier on, I caught a corner of what he was saying, the marginalized are always a reflection back to the center that is benefiting by persecuting a marginalized group. And everybody has the capacity to be that center, that persecuting center. Just because one group has been persecuted once, it doesn't mean that they can't turn that around to somebody else. And so I'd like to offer you a poem called Intercession for Lesbian and Gay Ugandans. And the law was overturned a few weeks ago on a technicality because there hadn't been the 66% of parliamentarians present when the law was passed. So that is currently just a technicality, and the Ugandan government are currently discussing whether or not they can quickly reintroduce the bill. And neighbouring Kenya has proposed a Stone the Gays Bill. And I know Ethiopia, there are certain legislative procedures happening at the moment, considering also the death penalty. And so one of the interesting things we must do is not think, oh, wow, listen to that happening all there in Africa. The people that I met who supported the death penalty started off exactly the same place where I hear people here who think that gay people are just probably problematic a bit, or maybe they could be cured. It all sounded desperately familiar to something I'm far too familiar with. And so the idea that that's a problem over there and that problem over there has nothing to do with the theology that we exported and continue to export in a new colonization is worrying, and we need to do some deep reflection on ourselves, not just alienating and stereotyping people in different places. So there's a poem here called, if I can find it, Intercession for Lesbian and Gay Ugandans. A particular bishop had been asked to make a comment about this a few years back when the bill had a lot of support, and he said, I don't want to get involved in a liberal agenda. So that's where the beginning of this poem comes from. Intercession for Lesbian and Gay Ugandans. This is not a liberal agenda. Think about the people and the prisons in Uganda. These are bodies like yours and mine. Close your eyes. Please close them. Do not open them until you've breathed a little deeper. Put the fingers of your one hand to the wrist of the other and keep your pulse a moment. Are you calm? Are you content in touching your own skin with your own safe and holy skin? Think about the people sleeping in the prisons in Uganda. This is not a liberal agenda. These are people, not quite corpses yet. And it's not about forgetting all your morals with some rationalist adjustment or some sad subjective judgment. The Samaritan did not sin, yet still was hated, berated, judged, and deemed a different kind of human. Think about the people sleeping in the prison in Uganda. This is not a liberal agenda. I, I said that I think it's important to recognize that just because a group of people has experienced marginalization, it doesn't mean that they're exempt from public critique. And I think that's really important for us in society. There can almost be a race to victimhood. And if you can assert your victimhood, that can seem to indemnify you from public critique. And that's something that needs to be constantly challenged by ourselves, to ourselves, first of all. And I think one of the things that can be misleading about the term LGBT or LGBTQ is that the community of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, that people there all think like, oh, aren't we all part of the one queer family? And there can be many gay men who are very practiced in the art of misogyny. And so I suppose this is a poem really about that. I was in a prayer group. I went along to a prayer group and a friend of mine had a crush on somebody in the prayer group, and it was a prayer group only for gay men. And I thought, I'm not going to go to something only for gay men, because there are few enough places in this area where LGBT people could meet for any kind of spirituality. But my friend had a crush on somebody in the group, and so he said, I don't want to go alone, come along with me. So I went along. And I was there during the annual discussion in this prayer group as to whether they'd allow the lesbians to join. And one of the men in the group said, I don't know any lesbians. What are they like? What do they do? I wonder if we could write to them and ask them to send one to speak to us. At which stage I started to write notes for the following poem. And I started to think, if one was to write to the Department of Lesbianism and ask them to send their public representative, to whom should one address the letter? And what would her title be? So the poem is called The Visit of the Queen of the Lesbians to the Gay Men's Prayer Group. I read it out, and a friend of mine came up to me and she said, Padraig, of all things that the chief lesbian would call herself, she would leave the term queen to the boys. But the poem was published then, so here it is. The Visit of the Queen of the Lesbians to the Gay Men's Prayer Group. When she came to visit, she said, don't ask me, I'm just the driver. When she came to visit, she said, questions reveal much about the secrets of the questioner. When she came to visit, she said, ask a better question, lads. She said, misogyny is no respecter of your homo-androcentric little whirlwinds. When she came to visit, she said, just because you don't want to screw us doesn't mean you don't screw us. So don't ask me to visit you. Answer your own queries. Queries. When she came to visit, she said, cook for us instead. That's what the Queen of the Lesbians said. Yesterday, during one of the 10x9s that we had with young people, there was a lovely girl got up, and she had an Irish name but an English accent. And she said, my grandfather is from Cork in Ireland. And she goes, and when we go to visit him, he talks to me and he says, blah, 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 blah. And I don't understand a word that he's saying. So in the off chance that you're sitting there hearing blah, 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 which I will say has alliteration and rhyme and rhythm, I wonder if anybody has a question or a comment or something that you'd like to say, and then I'll finish with a final poem after that. And there may be a roving mic. Oh, this might be it.
Oh, hello. This doesn't go very far, and for health and safety, we can't, like, walk into you. So if anyone can get to me or is on the front row, that would be ideal. Anyone?
I should have planted a question so I wouldn't feel awkward. Where did you get your fabulous shoes? Duck Feet. They're a Danish company. Hey, are you some Danes? Oh, fantastic.
I'm quite curious to know, how did it go in Uganda when you went? What was the reaction?
Yeah, so in terms of a pre-project to a project that we'd hoped to start, but once the law passed, it became complicated. It was a successful pre-project where we had 40 clergy, all of whom did ideologically support the death penalty. And we looked at the gospel texts and just simply asked, what is it that the gospel teaches us about the wisdom and insight and the gift that the marginalized are to the marginalizing center? And everybody likes to identify with the marginalized in the gospel. Oh, I'm like the woman who pushed through the crowd, or I'm like this, or I'm like that. And so it was very fruitful from the point of view of providing an avenue into thinking about these questions within the story that people held, and then asking, what does that mean now? And so it was fruitful as the beginning of a process to ask the question slightly differently. I wouldn't make too grand claims about it, but it was a fruitful beginning within that context and something I care very deeply about. Initially, people just thought, oh, we don't know who this Irish fella is. Somebody said, I Googled you and there's nothing about you, because there wasn't, because I changed the way I spelled my name. And then I said, oh, you know, I'm a very private person, which is a total and utter lie. But then after a few days, some curiosity emerged and somebody said to me, your wife, is she a theologian too? And I said, oh, I was thinking about the priesthood for a long time. And they were like, you're Catholic? I was like, thank God, we can just divert things now to questions to do with whether I'm a Mary worshipping Egypt rather than whether I'm a heterosexual Mary worshipping Egypt. So, but it was a very fruitful idea that I think we could work on. And so if anybody is interested and has and does on-the-ground work in Uganda, I'd be really interested in hearing from you. And we could do a little bit of collaboration in terms of spreading that kind of methodology. I'll happily share any of the methods we used in terms of opening up discussions as reflections back as well in terms of a critique of Christian involvement from the UK, Ireland, the United States and Uganda. So, any other questions?
Your mum obviously has a theological gift and a great way of reflecting on things as they are in a way which is sort of positive and constructive. So how does she talk to her friends in the Rosary Group about your being gay?
Say how does
your mum talk to the friends in the Rosary Group about your being gay in a way that kind of...
Yeah. I think one of the sadnesses of my life really is that I look at people of my parents' age, maybe my parents particularly, but other people of my parents' age and a bit older, for whom the vocabulary of authority has been given, where when I'm in front of them saying, I'm gay, I'm very happy being gay, I've got a loving partner, and my faith is deeper now and more vibrant now, that is just understood as being ununderstandable or probably wrong because it's different. And that is a great grief of power. And it's a great sin and trespass of power, of certainty, to say, here is what love looks like, and anything that doesn't look like what we're saying love looks like isn't love. And that is a tremendous idol of certainty that has caused anguish for many people in the name of religion, but also in the name of other things. Religion isn't the only culprit for setting up certainties like that. And so, it's complicated for them, slowly getting a little bit more used to things. But it's taken a while and it's taken courage. And it took me a long time to come out to them because I knew that when I did, I'd have to be in a place where I could support myself in whatever the complicated conversations would be afterwards. So it is something that I would hold religious leaders to account for, because the language used is a deeply dehumanizing language. And it also implies that LGBT people are incapable of love. And what we call love isn't love. And that's a desperate poverty of imagination, and there are ongoing consequences for that. So, one more question, or will we lash on with a poem or two? Yeah, what would a religion without certainty look like? One of the things I think is really interesting in the sequence of the texts in the New Testament is that it begins in narrative, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in terms of sequence, and then moves on to the analysis. And it implies that we start with story, and after the story comes the analysis of what's important. But in terms of the order in which those things are written, it seems like Paul had very little access to much of what we now call the content of the Gospels, and the Gospels came much later than most of the epistles. And I would like to see a New Testament arranged where we understand that what began in discursive theory, often using didactic models and kind of this and that, and you're in if you're this and you're out if you're that, landed into the subtlety and the variety of story that we have, where Jesus undoes Jesus, where there are four different kind of shapes to Jesus of Nazareth, four different hermeneutics and approaches, different reasons given for his life and his death, different things given in terms of what moved him, what he respected, what undid him. And we understand that in each of those, he was constantly surprised by the joy of interruption of people for whom he had time to listen to their circumstance, and that he seemed to understand himself. And it is a ludicrous claim, but he did seem to understand himself as God and had time in that context for the small interruption of the anonymous person, and saw within that a critique of the center. And I think the Gospels is often what religion without a particular kind of certainty can look like. So we don't need to go into modern theory for these things. I think within the Christian tradition, and within all traditions, but I know the Christian tradition best, there are tremendous ways of holding our certainties, or holding our hope, without colonizing what things should look like. Already there for us, if we could only have the eyes to read and the ears to hear, and the courage and the risk and the curiosity and surprise to notice what's around us every day. So, for instance, that the children who were telling us stories yesterday and today are full of the joy of discovery. And it's fantastic, absolutely fantastic, to listen to that rather than thinking, here's the answer for you. So I suppose that's what I think. A few years ago, so I wrote a master's dissertation in a college, a reformed college in Belfast. One time I was walking up the stairs in the college and I heard somebody behind me shout out, "Donal! Donal! Donal! Donal!" And it wasn't a college where many people yelled loudly. And I didn't know who Donal was, but I turned around anyway to see who was yelling. And the person was yelling at me. And they said, "Donal!" And I was like, "Padraig?" And he went, "Oh, are you the homosexual?" And part of me wanted to recommend that he retake the pastoral theology class. And part of me was like, "Yes, I am the homosexual, singular. There are no more." Anyway, I'm telling you this because in this college, it's a fantastic theological library, and I was doing a master's on the Gospel of Mark, and I was reading a commentary in the Gospel of Mark, which was genuinely thrilling. It was astonishing, incorporating literature and poetry and etymology. It was really fantastic. And I've forgotten the name of it. Don't be asking me, because I have forgotten the name of it. I turned to the back of it to see who else is the publisher, what other commentaries of the publisher published, because I was curious to see and maybe to get some of them. And I looked and they'd published, sure enough, commentaries in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of John, on 1st and 2nd Corinthians, on the facts of life, on the letter to the Hebrews, on 1st and 2nd Peter. And so nestled in between all these biblical commentaries, there was a little book on the facts of life, apparently. And seeing it there so blatantly in a way, in a list that didn't seem to own it, I thought, well, what are the facts of life? What are they, facts of life? And my mum told me when I was 11 that a seed goes into the mammy from the daddy and it's through the bum parts. And that was my introduction to the facts of life. And even at 11, because I told her I didn't know them when I did, even at 11, I remember thinking, I'm glad I know, before she explained it like that to me. But beyond the idea that that fact is simply the origin of what starts off something, what are the facts of life? So I'd like to finish with this poem. There is a signing in next door. Come in and have a chat. I offer this poem to you as a hope and a wish and a well-wishing. And in Irish, you can say berbua, which means kind of hold on to life, hold on to vivacity. And so as a berbua for all of us, that we can have the courage to notice what the facts of our life are and to tell those with confidence, with life and with hope, and to find the things that nurture us, to hold those things generously, to ask the critical questions of ourselves, but also to believe in the possibility of goodness that we can participate in. It's a great joy to be a Greenbelt. Greenbelt is a sanctuary and a home for me for many years and will continue to be. And it's lovely for to share this field with each other together. And so I'll end with this. The facts of life. That you were born and you will die. That you will sometimes love enough and sometimes not. That you will lie, if only to yourself. That you will learn most from the situations you did not choose. That you will get tired. That there will be some things that move you more than you can say. That you will live. That you must be loved. That you will avoid questions most urgently in need of your attention. That you began as the fusion of a sperm and an egg of two people who once were strangers and may well still be. That life isn't fair. That life is sometimes good and sometimes even better than good. That life is often not so good. That life is real. And if you can survive it, well, survive it well. With love and art and meaning given where meaning is scarce. That you will learn to live with regret. That you will learn to live with respect. That the structures that constrict you may not be permanently constricting. That you will probably be okay. That you must accept change before you die. But you'll die anyway. So you might as well live. And you might as well love. You might as well love. You might as well love. Thank you very much.